my work, or I haven't used this one. It doesn't seem.
There is one on the desk that connects to, and I think that.
I think the one on the desk there.
I mean, this one.
You can do the, yeah, I think can do the volume. Mm-hmm. Volume. Mm-hmm. Certainly one thing about how to make that work. Do you have any sound on anything in your
presentation? Yeah, but I plugged in, so we'll
you've
see
plugged
if it
in
works.
There. Yeah, it should.
It doesn't. It's, yeah.
Yeah. It has worked. I don't need to say it will, but it has. Okay. Yeah. I turned up to do one of my lectures the other day and the whole thing wouldn't work. But it was like 20 minutes in, we gave up. And the guy came, yes, and it doesn't be a problem. Okay, so we have a guest lecturer today, Professor Barbara Webb, who has been working in Edinburgh Informatics in the sort of robotics, vision, biological, cognitive modelling mixture of those areas for a number of years, and is going to talk to you about biological brains and behaviour. So I'll pass over to Barbara.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for turning up on this very nasty day at the very end of the semester. And I hope at least some of this will be entertaining as well as informative. So by now you've probably heard quite a lot about the cognitive science approach, I mean what we're trying to do in cognitive science. And it's an approach, you know, it should be familiar by now, the idea that what we're trying to do is propose computational mechanisms that account for some behavioral phenomena, normally some psychological phenomena, such as human speech or thought or reasoning or something. And then when we don't just hypothesize something, but the difference is that we actually build it. So we build this mechanism and we test if it actually behaves like the system that we're interested in. So in this lecture, that same approach applies, but there's two main differences from most of what you've heard about so far. So the first difference is we're going to be applying this approach to insect behavior instead of human behavior. And the second difference is that when we build these mechanisms, we're not just building them as a computational model, we're actually building real robots to test things out. So I'm just going to start by saying a little bit about why insects and why robots, and then we'll go on to some specific examples. Okay, so why insects? Well, the most obvious reason, as far as I'm concerned, for looking at insects is that they have much smaller brains than humans. In fact, the brain of the insect is probably about the size of the dot on the eye there compared to the human brain picture that I've sort of taken there. In fact, the difference is probably even bigger than this. You can basically fit an insect brain on the head of a pin. Okay, so we've just got a better chance of understanding a small brain than a big brain. Big brains are very, very complicated things. Even small insect brains are still very complicated things with something like 100,000 neurons, but there's some chance that we could actually build them and model them and understand them. Okay. And nevertheless, there's lots of interesting things that insects do that are actually common problems for all animals, including humans. So there's lots of things that you've talked about in cognitive science so far as human activities, but in fact, insects have to solve some of the same problems. So, for example, they have to recognize relevant sensory cues out there in the world. They have to choose the right actions to perform in response to those sensory cues. They don't just use one form of sensory cue, but they have to combine lots of different sources of information in an appropriate way. They have to adapt to circumstances and learn. They have to control complicated bodies. So there's lots of things that we do, you know, that aren't high-level thinking, but then nevertheless are quite essential to our capability to get on in the world. And indeed, many people argue that our so-called higher capacities, such as being able to speak language or you know, do logic problems or something like that, are actually built on this substrate of low-level capabilities. If we weren't able to sense things and understand what's going on in the world and get from A to B, then being able to think logically wouldn't help us at all. Being able to think logically is based on these lower level competences. And you may have come across this idea, and it's quite a a big idea in cognitive science at the moment, the idea that cognition is embodied, the fact that you're actually doing cognition, thinking, with a brain that's actually inside a body that has sensory input, has motor output, is actually quite key and essential to understand. Okay, so then why robots? Well, that kind of links back to what I just said about being embodied. Robots are embodied computers. That's really what a robot is. It's a computer brain that's inside a physical body that has to interact with the world. So they have to deal with the real world. We actually have to understand how do you get the information from the world and act on the world. So they have to solve the whole problem of cognition. Cognition isn't just in the head. It is actually doing something in the world. And not all of the intelligence that we display or that animals display is in the brain. A lot of it is in this interaction between the body, the brain, and the world. And of course, the other reason is robots are fun. So this is actually quite an old robot, which was really designed to explore the idea. Normally when you see robots walking around, they're very static, so they kind of stay very carefully, so they're always very well balanced on one leg or the other. And if they walk, they walk in this kind of very strange way like this. This set of researchers thought, well, really, that's not how we walk. We walk by being unbalanced and falling from one step to the other. And in fact, what you should do is try and build robots that can run and jump and do backflips before you try and do ones that can stay upright. So the reason it can keep doing things is because it's moving all the time. It's dynamically controlled. Okay, so let's look at a specific example of trying to take an insect system and build a robot model of it. So this is a system that I've been looking at for a long time, and there's lots of different ongoing studies. So the work I'm going to describe is reasonably old, but I'll give you a few updates as well as we go along. So this behavior is crickets. Anyone, what are crickets famous for? What do you think of when you think of a cricket? What do crickets do that we notice? The sound, yeah, so crickets sing. So why do crickets sing? Sorry, say louder. Anyone? To communicate, but what are they trying to communicate? Any idea? A few mutterings. I mean, why would you bother singing if you're a cricket? It's the male crickets that are singing. Yeah, so they're basically trying to attract female crickets, exactly. So that's what male crickets are doing. So they actually move one wing over the other, and this produces little bursts of sound, which look something like this. So each of these is just a little burst of sound as it closes its wings. And so they actually have quite a distinctive pattern, and different species of crickets you can recognize from their song patterns. And female crickets are attracted to this song. So even if you play back... that's not working. Never mind. It probably worked better if I do it like this. Hold on. Oh, I know why it's not working. Let me do it again. Okay. Let's try that again. Okay, so you can hopefully hear that now. So what we're actually playing back to this female cricket is actually just a kind of synthesized male cricket sound. So it's not even a real male cricket. It's just a simple copy of that sound. And she can't see a male cricket, she can't smell a male cricket, but nevertheless, she goes charging off trying to find a male cricket. So seems like a very simple, very reactive behavior. She hears the sound, she tries to go towards the sound. Okay. So we can actually test this in quite some detail by actually putting one of these female crickets on a treadmill. So she's walking on top of this little treadmill, and we're playing the song from one side, and then we switch it to the speaker that you can maybe see behind here. So at the moment, the sound's from over here, and then we switch the sound over, and she turns
side left
and walks in that direction. And in fact, a female cricket will do this for sometimes up to an hour on this trackball, even though the sound's only 50 centimeters away. So again, it seems like a very simple reflex behavior. She hears the sound, she goes towards the sound. Okay. And people have proposed models of how she does this. So a first model has been that she follows the simple rule, turn towards the ear more strongly stimulated. It sounds quite straightforward. And this, these people who did cricket research actually wrote this, we use the word simple because a two-eared robot programmed to obey this rule, if suitable noise was incorporated, could be made to track a sound source in a manner like the female. So I thought, okay, I'll build a robot with two ears and see if I can make it track a sound source like the female cricket. So this is the robot. There's been several different versions of this robot, but this is one version. It has two ears, which are two microphones. It has some electronics that process the sound in a way like the female cricket, which I'll come back to in a moment. And then it has a microprocessor that we can program to represent the brain of the cricket and to suggest different ways that the ears could be connected to the wheels to actually make this robot move towards the sound. Okay, so it starts out with this simple rule, turn towards the ear more strongly stimulated. And immediately it turns out it's not as simple as it sounds, okay? We put the ears on our robot about the same distance apart as the ears are on a cricket. Does anyone know where the ears are on the cricket? It's actually an interesting thing. They actually have ears on their legs, okay? Their two front legs have their ears. So this distance is actually a very short distance. It's about 2 centimeters apart, depending on the size of the cricket, obviously. So if we take this small robot and we play it a sound from some distance away, the question is, well, you know, if the sound is, say, 2 meters away and it's traveled this far, then the difference in the sound between these two ears is going to be really tiny. It's probably going to be swamped by the background noise, other things going on, okay? In fact, does anyone know how we hear the direction of sound? Okay, we're quite good if we hear a sound, we know which way to turn. Anyone know how we do that? Or have any guesses about how we might do it with two ears? What could we use? Yeah?
Through the different form of the ear itself, but it changes the frequency.
Okay, so that's a slightly more complicated way, but it is part of what we do, yeah, is the fact that we have the shape of the ear. So sound coming from behind us will sound slightly different from sound coming towards us. But anything simpler than that? I mean, if a sound is coming from one side, what might give us a cue?
Intensity.
Yeah, the intensity. So part of the thing is just that we have a big head that's in between our two ears. So sound coming from this side is quite louder than sound coming from that side. Anything else that's different? Anyone heard of yours? I mean, the main second cue is the time difference as well. So the time it reaches this one will be slightly before the time it reaches this one, although it's a very short time. And in fact, we have some quite complicated neural machinery that lets us actually detect this very small time difference. And for sounds that are actually low frequency sounds that have a high wave, low frequency, so it's a long wavelength, they actually don't get blocked by our head very well because they can kind of go round our head. And so then we use this time difference. Okay, so that's fine. It could be an amplitude difference, or it could be a time difference that we could use for our robot or that the cricket could use. But in fact, both of these are quite difficult for the cricket because it's very small. So basically, it doesn't really get much blocking of the sound from one side to the other. There's not much time difference. There's really no amplitude difference. And the cricket has actually come up with a completely different solution to this problem. So I presume you're not familiar with the central nervous system of a cricket. This is a kind of see-through cricket picture that lets you see a little bit. So as I said, the ears are actually on the legs here and here. They do have a nervous system. They have a brain. And then they have something that's a bit like a spinal cord, a set of ganglia that run down their body. But the key thing here is actually that the ears are connected to each other. So here what's being shown is actually a tracheal tube, an air-filled tube, because they actually breathe through these spiracles here. And the two ears are actually connected to each other through this tube. And what this allows the cricket to do is to actually hear the direction of sound. And it's a really neat solution. Is there chalk anywhere?
In the drawer.
Okay, so I'm going to do a kind of simplified version. If you imagine there's two ears and they're connected by an airfield tube, okay? And the length of this tube is 1/4 of the wavelength of the sound. Okay, we'll just imagine that for a moment. And that actually is about true for the cricket. So if sound is coming from this side, it hits this eardrum, but it also travels around the outside of the cricket and hits this eardrum and comes through and hits this eardrum on the inside as well. Okay, so the sound at the eardrum is actually both the direct sound and the indirect sound. So anyone like to say, what's the phase relationship of these two sounds? Okay, so if one sound is like this, how shifted in phase would this sound be after traveling round and back? If this is a quarter wavelength. It's not that high. So it's a quarter plus a quarter, so it's a half wavelength. In other words, it's completely out of phase, yeah? Okay, so it's shifted out of phase. So what will actually happen then at this eardrum when those two waves arrive? That's the obvious thing to say, but actually they're on opposite sides of this eardrum. So they actually add together. Okay, so what happens is that when this wave is pulling, the other wave is pushing, and vice versa. So you actually get twice as much vibration here as you would otherwise. Whereas on this side, so the sound's still coming from that direction, these two waves, are they in phase, out of phase? Yeah, they both travel the same distance. One's traveled through and one's traveled round, but they've traveled the same distance. So they're in phase with each other on opposite sides of the eardrum. So they cancel out. Okay, you get no response over here. Okay, so basically just this simple physical mechanism means that the direction that the sound comes from, you get much bigger response on that side than the other side. But only if the sound is a particular wavelength. Yeah? And as far as the cricket's concerned, that's great, because what the cricket wants to do is recognize the wavelength of the sound as being a male cricket, okay? And it doesn't want to react to other sounds. It only wants to react to male crickets. Okay, so just to kind of recap that, this is called a pressure difference receiver. The sound traveling from... It's a little bit more complicated because you actually have these multiple openings. So the sound here is actually a sum of both the direct sound and the indirect sound that's come through all these openings and all adds up at the right tympanum and vice versa for the left. But you can basically model that as a simple delay and add. So basically the input to the left ear is delayed and subtracted from the right ear because it's the opposite side of the eardrum. And similarly, the input from the right ear is delayed and subtracted from the left ear. And the result of that is that you get good directionality from the physical system. So there's nothing internal that's having to do this. It's not the brain that's working out where the sound is coming from. It's all being done by the physical system. Okay, so that's the kind of first stage that we had to put into the robot. And then we looked to try and build a kind of simple model of the brain and how it controls the approach to sound. And this is a very simple model with only 4 neurons. Basically, you get input from the left ear and the right ear so that this neuron spikes and this neuron spikes. But obviously, this one will spike more if the sound is on the left and this one if it's on the right. And that will drive a motor response to turn in the appropriate direction to whichever one is louder. And it also inhibits from the opposite side. So basically, what happens is that if this one fires... this neuron starts firing first, it's going to excite this and also prevent any response to the other side, so you don't get a conflict between the two. So the circuit is basically comparing which side the sound started the neurons firing first. Okay. So it looks a bit like this. This is the sound input. This is the neuron actually spiking in response to the sound input. And then that passes through to this neuron, and basically you have to have enough spikes coming often enough for it to add up and control the system. There's a little bit of extra complexity there, but I think in the interest of time, I'll skip it and just sort of show you the general outcome, which is now we can actually test the robot and see if it behaves in the same way as female crickets behave. So now we have real male crickets singing away, and what you'll see, so you can see their wings moving as they sing to each other. And this is the robot. So it's being tested in the real world with real sound input, with the complexities of, you know, they start singing, they stop singing, sometimes they sing overlapping and so forth. But you can see it's able to find its way towards the sound. So essentially it's making a turn every time it hears the sound is louder on one side versus the other. But again, to get it to behave in a cricket-like way, there's quite a lot of slightly more complicated tuning that you have to do. So that kind of gives you a close-up. So again, you can see there's the two ears up here. This circuit now is basically doing this for us in electronics instead of in physics, and then it's programmed with this very simple neural control model. Unfortunately, the male crickets are a bit disappointed when the female robot turns up. Okay. So we could do various tests on this and show, for example, that the robot had the same preferences as the cricket. It was actually selective. So this is sort of showing the behavior. If the sound is at 45 degrees, the robot would lock on to the sound and go towards the sound very successfully, but only if the syllable rate, the repetition rate, or the pattern in the song was the right kind of song. So it could kind of compare the behavior of crickets with different songs and the robot with different songs. It was also actually able to choose between several syllable rates. So if you had one that's more like a cricket, which is a 40 millisecond syllable repetition interval versus 60, it was able to choose the right one to go to. And this is actually something that if you listen to these two sounds, it's actually, for us, it's almost impossible to hear this distinction. It would also choose based on the frequency of the sound. So it would prefer the correct frequency, which is basically this wavelength, okay? So it's tuned to this particular wavelength, this frequency of sound, and it could choose that sound even when there's a distracting sound that's a different wavelength. Okay, we also tested this outdoors with a slightly different robot base, because those little wheels wouldn't work outdoors. So this is the robot base here. It's called a WEGS robot because it has something that's halfway between wheels and legs. Looks a bit like this. So basically, each of these wheels is a three-legged wheel. And the way it works is that as it drives itself forward, the foot on this side will be out of sequence with the foot on that side. So you get an alternating placing of those feet. The foot on this side at the front will be down at the same time as the foot on the opposite side in the middle, as the same time as the opposite side at the back. So you get what's called the tripod gait. In other words, it puts down these three legs, and then it puts down those three legs, which is what most insects actually do. It's a very stable gait because you always have three points of contact with the ground. So this robot is able to do that. It was actually based on experiments people did on cockroaches. It had another little feature, which is that each of these axles is actually a compliant axle. So what happens if the robot runs up, for example, to a step, and the first foot can get on the step, but it can't actually pull the robot over the step, is that the other wheel will keep rotating round until both legs are on the step, and then it can often get over the step, so as is kind of illustrated here, and then they'll pop back out of sync again. So again, it's purely mechanical. There's nothing computational here, but the mechanics allows it to actually climb over steps and obstacles. So we basically put the ears are now down here, close to the ground, which is more like an insect, and we can run this outdoors. So let me show you.
Okay, program download.
This was done on a very wintry day, which is not a day when crickets would normally go out, but you get the idea. And this is not sped up film, this is how fast this robot actually runs. And you can then see. there's the sound. Okay. This just sort of shows you from close up, you can maybe just about see down the bottom where the ears are. The robot actually steers a bit more like a car than an insect. And this turned out to be a bit of a problem because, in fact, when this robot is trying to get towards sound, its turning circle is actually a lot bigger than the turning circle of a cricket. So we get into problems like this where it just couldn't get to the sound. So even though in some ways it looks more like the insect, in other ways it was actually less like the insect than before. Okay. So I mentioned at the beginning, you know, that insects don't just do simple sensory motor reflex behavior, but they actually do more complicated things. And here's one example. What if the cricket also has visual input, okay? And in particular, there's a particular visual reflex that we have that pretty much every animal has, which is if the entire world seems to be rotating around you visually, it's usually not the world that's rotating, it's usually you are slipping relative to the world. So you think you're not moving, but in fact you are moving. It's like when you're on the train and you start to see the other train go past and then you realize it's actually you moving. And our eyes, if you rotate our entire visual field, our eyes will follow that rotation. Crickets can't rotate their eyes, so they'll just follow, their entire body will follow that rotation. And you can see this in lots of different animals. So what we did in this experiment was the cricket is now kind of fixed on top of this trackball. We're playing a sound to it, so it's trying to turn towards that sound. And at the same time, we're rotating the visual input around it. Okay, and so we can either rotate that in the same direction or in a different direction, and we can say, well, what does the cricket do? Does it try to react to both of these things? Does it try and add these two things together and turn somewhere in between? Does it just ignore vision and respond to sound, or does it just ignore sound and respond to vision? What does it do? The initial motive for doing this was that people had said, well, what it does is just add the two together. Okay, it just adds the two turning tendencies. So this is what's being shown in this graph. It's maybe not very clear. So what's along this axis is the direction of the sound, and the line in the middle shows how much the cricket will try to rotate. If the sound is on one side, it will try to rotate in that direction. If the sound's on the other side, it will rotate in that direction. And then you add in this visual motion in one direction or in the other direction, and what you find is that seems to shift how much it rotates. So it's still doing the rotation to sound, but it's added on extra rotation to vision, either this way or the other way, okay? So this seemed very straightforward and something that we could easily put onto our robot. We could just get a simple visual system that could get this, had this reflex of when it saw visual motion, it would turn in that direction. And we could add that to our one that reacted to the sound, and we could just add the two things together, and we would, you know, be able to replicate what the cricket did. And this is one version of this robot, so it's actually got a very nice analog VLSI chip that's doing the visual motion detection, and it's still got the microphones, it's still turning towards the sound. And what it turned out was that it doesn't work at all. It doesn't work for reasons that are actually obvious in retrospect. You didn't really have to build a robot to understand why it didn't work, but we didn't realize until we built the robot. So basically what happens is that the robot's going along, it hears the sound over here, it turns towards the sound. As it turns towards the sound, it gets visual motion in the opposite direction, and so it turns back away from the sound because that's what the visual motion is telling it to do. So basically, the visual motion is trying to make it not turn, and the auditory input is trying to make it turn, and it can't just add those together because it would never get to sound. It would be a disaster as far as the cricket's concerned. So we then had to think about, you know, well, what are the alternatives? How might it combine these two things together? So there's actually quite a few different possibilities you can consider. So if we imagine there's a turning response to sound, that's the phono response, which has a certain gain, and there's a turning response to vision, which is the opto response. We need to combine those, but the problem that I just mentioned is that you get this feedback. So if you turn to sound, then you get feedback on yourself which is visual motion, which would make you turn the wrong way. So the problem is that these two things are interacting. And of course, they interact the other way as well. If you turn towards the vision, that turns you away from the sound as well. Okay, so the two things are interacting. So you might think, okay, maybe you can just kind of balance the gains or something to get this to work. But actually, there really is no way to do it. You can actually show with control theory that there's no way to do it that way. So what can we do? So I just said, okay, adding them together basically isn't very successful. You could say, okay, well, whenever I turn towards sound, I should just ignore everything I see. So I should turn, pretend I'm blind while I'm turning, and then once I'm going towards the sound, then I can look around again. So that would be to simply inhibit the output of your visual system. However, if you think about it, actually what would be better is to inhibit the input to your visual system. Actually, you want to say, okay, I don't even want to integrate anything that's coming in at the moment. So you should interact at this point. But there's something even better that the cricket could be doing. And this is to say, not just I should ignore vision, I should be blind when I'm turning, but that I should predict what I should see. Okay, if I'm turning this much, I know that I'm going to get this much visual motion, and then I can still remain sensitive to any extra visual motion. So if I'm still slipping too far, I'll still see that I'm slipping too far because I only tried to turn 30 degrees, but I saw 60 degrees of motion, or vice versa. So this is actually quite an old idea called efference copy, but it's quite a nice and very powerful idea for trying to combine sensory systems. However, it does imply that the cricket is doing something quite clever in its brain. It means it's actually predicting what it's going to see in the future. And in fact, we do exactly this. Okay, so when you move your eyes around, the world, you keep getting completely different views of the world every time you move your eyes, which is several times per second. But it doesn't feel like the world is jumping about, does it? No? Okay. But if you actually if you close one eye and push on the side of your eyeball, like that, just, you know, on the skin, but just beside your eyeball and push, you'll see the world jiggles. Yeah? So when you move your eyes and you know you're moving your eyes, then your brain is compensating immediately and predicting how everything in the world is going to shift and look. And so therefore you don't see it as jumping around. But when you do this, which is not normally how your eye is moved, then in fact you do see the world jumping around because you haven't got that prediction system operating in your brain. Okay. So it's actually quite a complicated system. So it looks something like this. The idea is that, you know, we have sensors, we have sensory processing, they give us motor commands that cause things in the world. But at the same time, every time we do something, or every time the insect does something, it also predicts what's going to happen, what it's going to see next. Okay, and it's really quite an interesting and powerful idea to think that's going on in the brain of a small animal like the cricket. Because essentially, you have to model what's going on in the world. You have to know what's going to happen when I do this action. How is that interaction of my body and the world going to affect my senses? So it's really quite a complicated thing, and several people have recently argued that in fact this is really the foundation of cognition, of being able to predict what's going to happen in the future, is part of even very simple sensory motor control systems seen in insects. Okay. So, and we actually have some evidence that the cricket even can learn this from experience. So not only that it makes the prediction, but that it updates its prediction to be better from its own feedback and experience. Okay, so are insects really that intelligent? You might have some doubts. So let me show you another experiment that we've done with crickets that actually shows they can do something that's comparable to rats, at least. Have any of you heard of the Morris water maze? Is that familiar at all? Okay, I'll start this running and just turn it off as well, and then explain what's going on. So the Morris water maze basically is a pool of water where it's kind of milky, so the you can't see under the surface, and you throw a rat into this pool of water, and somewhere under the water there's a little platform, and if it finds the platform it can climb out of the water and not be in the water. So it swims around furiously, eventually it finds the platform and comes out. Then you throw it in the next time, and it swims much more directly to where the platform is. And you throw it in the next time, and it really zooms straight there and sits on this platform. So people have been looking at this in this quite an old experiment, but there's literally thousands of papers about the memory, the place memory that the rat has for doing this. So this, what I'm showing you here, is actually exactly the same thing, but for a cricket. So instead of using water, the bottom of this maze, of this arena, is heated up. So the cricket doesn't like it very much. It's about 45 degrees. And there's one spot here which you can't see, and the point is you can't see it because the cricket can't see it either, which is actually cool. So if it can find that cool spot, then it's out of the heat and it's happy, okay? And the question is, can it then, when we put it in again, can it actually get there faster? Can it learn to get there quicker? You can see it's looking a bit unhappy. This is what rats do as well. It spends a lot of time trying to go around the outside and see if it can escape. However, by the third trial, you can see it's behaving quite differently. So it's now, for example, seems to be keeping some distance from the walls. And in fact, in a moment, you'll see that it's on the cool spot. And we always know when it's on the cool spot because it never moves again. It stays there because it knows it's safe. Okay, so now we throw it in again a couple of trials later. And you don't want to anthropomorphize, but it looks like it's looking around, you know, and looking at the different things. And then it goes pretty much directly to the cool spot and stops there after just six trials. And that's about how long it takes a rat to learn this paradigm. Okay, so just to show you the idea, so basically we measure how long it takes to get to the cool spot as we give it more and more trials, and that time decreases. Interestingly, it actually decreases faster if we don't use these big black and white things, but instead use what we call a natural scene. So you basically take a bit of scenic wallpaper and put it around the outside. And the cricket actually learns it really fast then and finds the cool spot in like 10 or 20 seconds on average by the end. And we can prove that it is actually using this visual surroundings, that it doesn't have some other cue or some, you know, thermal gradient or something it can follow by rotating the cues. So here we rotate the visual surroundings and we look to see whether the cricket goes to the same spot as it went to before, so the actual cool spot, or whether it goes to the kind of fictive cool spot, the cool spot where it would be if it was relative to the visual surroundings, or if it goes to some other random place. Which one does it get to first? How long does it take to get to each of those places? And what we find is it very clearly goes to this fictive cool spot. It goes to the place in relation to the visual surroundings. And this is exactly what people have seen in the rat for a long time. Okay, so then obviously we were interested to try and understand how does the cricket do this? What is it learnt that allows it to find the cool spot again? And there's lots of actual different ways to solve this problem. So we put this now again, it's on a robot. This robot has a camera that's looking up at a ball bearing, which basically gives it a 360-degree view of the world, a very distorted view, but it can see in every direction, which is like insects can do. And this is what it can see, basically. So here, it's looking at an arena where the walls are more or less blank. Here it's looking at one which has these landmarks. Here it's looking at this natural scene. Okay, so we can collect data and ask what can the robot see in all these different situations, and can it use what it can see to get home again? And we basically had a framework to compare several different models of how it could do this homing behavior, where we used what we call a cricket eye model, which is a model of how bad the vision of a cricket is, which is really bad. It's incredibly fuzzy. So this is what the image looks like by the time it's been filtered through the eye of a cricket, okay? It's very poor information. We can then put in different visual homing models and plug them into the robot so that it makes a decision about which way to go and then see what it sees and keep updating that and so on. And what we were trying to do was to reproduce this preference of the cricket for, in particular, these natural scenes over the different landmarks. So we actually tested lots of different models. I'm just going to describe two of them so you get a sense of some possibilities here. So one model is called the average landmark vector model. People have proposed this as how ants find their way home. Lots of ants use visual information to find their way home. And it's a very simple idea. So the basic idea is this. You start out at your home, where you want to get back to, and you have a little vector that points to each edge of a landmark that you can see. So those are these vectors here. So you just, everywhere in the world you can see a sharp edge, you stick a vector in that direction. You sum all those vectors together, and you get this vector sum here, which is this little red vector. And you just store that. You store this average landmark vector. Then you go off for a walk, and you end up at this new place. And in this new place, you again have a look around, and you put a vector in the direction of every landmark you can see. And you add together all those vectors, and you get this little blue vector here. That's the average landmark vector in this new position. If you then subtract this little red vector from the blue vector, what you get is this green vector. And this green vector is pointing exactly the direction you need to go to get home. Okay? So all you need to do is take the difference of two vectors, and then you can move in the homeward direction. So it's actually a very simple but very effective algorithm. Unfortunately, it doesn't work, it doesn't reproduce the data from the cricket. So in particular, it works really well when you have these very distinct landmarks, and not so well when you have a more natural scene. Then this is just a second suggestion for how crickets or insects might home, and it's called the binary difference model. So what you do here is say, okay, I'm not going to try and see edges or anything. I'm just going to be really, really stupid about it. And basically, if I look around and what I see here, okay, I just store that image completely just as what I see. If I move to here, that image will have changed a bit. If I just do a pixel by pixel comparison, there will be a bit of a change. If I move to here, there will have been more of a change. If I move to here, there will have been more of a change, and so on. So basically, as I go away from my home position, the difference between what I see now and what I saw before increases. And what's a little surprising is that it actually increases in quite a predictable way. I mean, obviously, if I go all the way out the door, then it changes completely, and it's no use to me anymore. But as long as I'm within this room, I can just say, well, am I getting closer or further? So every time I move, do things look more like they did before or less like they did before? If they look more like they did before, I'll keep going. And if they look less like they did before, then I'm going the wrong way, so I'll try going in another direction. So you're just doing a simple kind of gradient descent on the image difference. So that's what I'm sort of trying to illustrate here. So this is the position in space on X and Y, and then Z is how much the image has changed as you move away from X or Y. And what you can see is that you actually get these nice smooth different surfaces, which you can go home on, and that this works really well if you have a very complicated natural scene compared to if you have a few distinct landmarks. Okay, so probably time for some conclusions. This just kind of gives you a flavor of what we're doing and what we're interested in. And really what I would like you to take away, as it were, as a message, one is that cognitive science is, okay, it's about building models, but not just of the human mind and brain, but also of the body, how the sensory systems work, how our motor systems work, how those things interact. And it's obviously a very difficult problem, okay, to try and solve all of that at once. There's lots of different ways people divide up the problem. So people work on perception, people work on motor systems, people work on memory, people work on language, and so forth. I mean, normally what people do is to study and to model just one small part of this whole complex system that makes up what we can do. So the complementary approach that I've been presenting is, in fact, instead to say, let's try and study and to build the whole of a simpler system, such as an insect. And the advantage of that is that then you really start to understand how these different things interact, how the body and the mind and the processing all interact, and how they interact with the world that the system finds itself in. So I think I'll finish. We're done. Happy to answer any questions if there's a few minutes for questions. Yes, and I mean there's, yeah, I mean if you look, you should be able to find me pretty easily, and there's links to papers about this work if you want to follow up any more about any of it, or just ask me personally. You don't have to ask in front of everyone, but if you want to ask me later, just do. Okay, thank you.
Nice way to bring together quite a lot of other things.
Good.
From earlier. So, yeah.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I'm writing my translation with amnesia.
Right.
And that is slightly different from the topic that is,
slightly different topics.
From the confabulation topic.
Right.
So, should I define what confabulation is?
Yes.
Should I define what amnesia is?
I think you have to think of the targets
of the landmarks. Are they pre-programmed into the robot, or does it sort of recognize something that may be of significance?
Yeah, no, it has to. You have to have a filter that, for example, looks for edge, an edge detecting filter or something like that. Yeah.
Okay.
And then it becomes a question of, well, what's the best mechanism for that?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But so does it have? Does it just look for edges, or is it like a specific shape?
So in this model, it's just looking for edges,
for
changes from light to dark or dark to light, basically.
Okay.
But there's a lot of evidence that a lot of visual systems do that. I mean, there's a lot of examples of even our visual system is quite good at edge detection. Yeah.
Okay.
Because it's very well referenced. It has, I think, 50 or 60 references.
Can you make a different spin on it or a different angle of it or a different subset of it?
I can include some criticism.
We'll do that then rather than say do a different one altogether, which at this stage might be quite a lot of work.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And, by the way, how can I get a hold of a memory book?
There should be copies in the library.
If we actually
checked that for the textbook,
copies
at the library. There should be
some
in the reserve section.
I checked yesterday.
Nothing in the reserve section?
Nothing. Really?
Really?
Yes.
Oh,
they say that they have those books, but they don't have them. And I don't know who was it, but someone suggested emailing Alyssa. Because she has in
I've got
the book and because I know that's a problem. So.
Well, I mean, are there any other memory textbook as well? It doesn't have to be that specific one. There are earlier
I know, but the topics that were described, they referenced the book. And
but there will be other sources. I mean, if you look online, there will be other sources.
Yeah, I found some sources already.
Yeah.
But the assignment requires to write about the confabulation in patients with amnesia and to read the beginning in the book.
But the reason for that is saying that's an easy place. We can say you will find that stuff, okay. But it will be in a lot of other places as well, okay. So, but we did ask them put the copies of the reserve sections. So that's useful to know that they aren't there.
When I went there, there was another girl.
Yeah, I think you just have to look and see what other sources you can find on the same material.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So we gave them the assignment of doing a Wikipedia article.
Okay.
A good Wikipedia article. Moderator, although it is a bit of a problem in the visual robotics area.
Mm-hmm.
So
I know you've all got a number of projects involved, so maybe you're up to that and everything. Taken over the graduate schools.
Yeah.
So you will get some second round, but didn't in the end. We're gonna have to see how it works.
I was going to go shopping after this. So I need to buy a week party for my dress.
Mm-hmm.
And then shoes. But, no. But apparently tomorrow it's just going to be cool with the setting.
Okay.
It's tomorrow morning.
Oh, yeah.
Sort of. Yeah, like when I was getting here, but that's going to be like warm-ish when the wind. And the wind isn't blowing.
Yeah.
And it's not like feels good. It's actually okay.
Yeah.
But then the wind will be like, what do you wish for this? Sweater again today. First time in ages.